awake.
Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be deadly serious. All right, so I'm going to talk about derivative interactions. And the first, basically two parts. The first part, probably a lot of you have heard, but actually I'm interested to say it again, especially in light of the discussion that I found here this morning. And from these two papers, and the second half looks a little bit separated, but it's really going to be using the stuff derived here in a different context. And those two parts are first just looking at sort of a very generic single field cyclotron and asking what are sort of the properties that we can extract from the most generic case, especially properties that are relevant for observation. So as we discussed today, non-Gaussian is a good way to distinguish between, what was it, white dwarfs and primordial gravitational waves, something like that. But of course, they're very good for distinguishing qualitatively different physics by variable inflation. So it's nice to be able to characterize completely what we might look for in that case. And then the second thing is just taking what we learned here and applying it to sort of a completely different context where you might want to use a completely different framework of looking at inflation to be able to ask sort of more global questions. And the question is if there's any way that we can take over some of the utility of this procedure for the case of small systems. Okay, so the first part. You can take several approaches. I mean, this is sort of the name of the conference is effective field theory of inflation, but so far nobody's really summarized the approaches that you can take. So let me do that now. So the earliest approach was to just look at stuff that sort of looks like k-inflation, which is first derivative interactions, and this is moving on in collaborators. You can completely reorganize the information and talk about the effective theory of fluctuations, which was done by Chung et al. Or you can actually say, well, what's the effective theory of the inflatorn? And the difference between these two is just sort of where you put the effect. So there could be lots of terms in the inflatorn action that contribute to, say, the three-point of fluctuation. So it's just an organizational scheme. But if you're coming at this from the point of view of looking at some fundamental scalar field, it might be slightly more natural to first organize things in this way. And at least at the four derivatives, this was done recently by Stephen Weinberg. And then there's sort of special cases of all of this. Where you have some reason to write down a particular action that you might not necessarily have thought of from any of these points of view. So what I want to do in the first part is just sort of generalize these two approaches and see what generic properties come out. So why do we care? Well, we like to have workshops, essentially, but but of course what we really want is to understand a fundamental description of inflation, which involves correlation functions and loop corrections and all this stuff. And the reason that other people care about this is because we might be able to actually observe those in some meaningful way and then say, what is the fundamental physics of inflation? Okay, so let me review, first of all, I don't think anyone did this yet, just briefly what the single field fluid looks like. This is just a model with first derivative interactions. So aside from the gravitational piece, you have this P of X and phi, P because it's the pressure, and X is this kinetic term, and phi is inflatorn. And this was written down in various contexts, first by Mukhanov, and then in particular used for its non-Gaussian features by these people. And to summarize the changes in the physics from this, you know, compared to slow roll, you basically just need, in addition to your usual slow roll parameters, you need a new parameter, which is the sound speed, which characterizes, you know, your deviation from that standard kinetic term. And physically, all that does is rescale the horizon for the scalar fluctuations. So you have your slow roll parameters, this thing, and maybe the variation of this thing, the scale, as well. And that's pretty much all you need. So given that that's what you need sort of phenomenologically, you can still go back and ask, what kind of an action does this come from, and what kind of CS or running or slow roll parameters can you generate? So I think we already saw this this morning from Jan here, but sort of an early take on this was done by Carminelli, where he said, well, let's just take the usual thing and assume that there's some scale of new physics n here that comes in with these derivative terms. And as long as this thing is small, what you might naturally do is just start expanding in powers of x and learn before. Usually, I think sort of in a sort of a typical slow roll scenario, we imagine that n is m Planck, and then there's no way that this effect is important. The thing that came out of maybe the DDI model was the idea that this could be considerably lower than like the string scale, the Warp string scale. And then you get into a regime where these terms actually might be interesting. And so specifically, that was this case where you had a reason, you know, from string theory, or you can just make other symmetry types of arguments, you had a reason to actually sum up all of this set of terms, which allowed you to work in a regime where x over 4 was close to 1, which is a very small sound speed and a very large non-Gaussian.
Well, that has the property that x over m
where it can be close to one, and yet you can still make like higher derivatives, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's going to be part of what, what is the consistent sort of, what are the conditions under which, first of all, you can treat this thing, under which you can sum up the whole of this thing and ignore higher derivatives, things like that.
So you can address it to whether or not that's the only thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Punchline of part one. You already know it. So what you might do, sort of a more general take from what Carmelli did, is to say, well, let me instead expand the number of derivatives. Let me do sort of an energetic expansion. And at each order, write down all the unique terms, up to integration of vectors or whatever, use the equation of motion so that we're effectively treating these things as perturbations and not taking these higher derivatives seriously, see what remains, and classify those terms. Oops. Yeah. So at four derivatives, that looks pretty simple. You can write down seven possible terms for the scalar field. There are three unique terms. It's pretty easy to guess what they look like. X squared, X box y, box y squared. Some gravitational stuff, and it turns out that that doesn't matter at all at this level. You're still going to end up with a very limited set of terms. You use the equation of motion, so you replace box y in terms of the derivative of the potential. And you can see that you're just left with this function. And all that you've done is sort of change the function that sits in front of this term by something that depends on potential solar parameters, essentially. So there's a small change to this function, you're left with this, and at four derivatives, what you would write down for P and X and phi model is all there is. So the reason to continue this procedure, basically, is first of all to address the question that Cliff just asked. If I go to higher order, I probably have higher derivatives, and do I have a single derivative condition, multiple derivative conditions left? How do I know when I'm including everything I need to include consistently? And the second reason is that essentially if I truncate the action, I've truncated how many correlation functions or fluctuations I can calculate. The X squared term only contributes to the 3-point and 4-point plus gravitational pieces. So clearly if I want to uncover sort of the structure of higher correlation functions for the fluctuations, I also need to keep going in the action. So by continuing the action, we're going to uncover the structure of correlation functions that comes out of that perturbative condition. Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
yeah, access
doesn't
have
to be a vacuum, or
can it always
encapture the box?
Yeah. I mean, as long as it's a perturbation around the original solution, it shouldn't have to be.
Wait, another way of saying it is, instead of using a gradient of motion, you can just do a field redefinition against your distances. So you don't have to say which solution you're interested in.
Why is it different from
there you can remove the box as well, but to do so you would be exasperated. It would just be much more complicated than
that. Any ghost inflation? You said?
For the gravitation for the box.
I mean, if I took this seriously, right, I would end up with that same problem. I would end up with an extra degree of freedom.
You can do it there as well.
Okay, so if we continue to six derivatives, I think as it turns out, this is as far as we need to go, which is good.
When you include gravity, there is, you can also have du nu phi, g nu nu.
That's right. Right. So some of those get removed by.
Well, you can't get rid of them.
Sorry, which one?
So, well, you can have functions as well, phi x, you can have nu phi, g nu nu. And you could remove that with a field redefinition.
Sorry, that's what I have.
You mean R mu?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that you can have in the action without it doesn't get higher to equations of function.
Right.
And that's just as an accident, because if you go to the gauge or phi the function of t, you just pick out g0, which of course doesn't have the right.
That's a good point. Yeah, so I mean there, and even removing checking all of the other gravitational terms, our mean is pretty easy to identify some other contractions that you have to actually go to the fluctuations to see how they get sort of. So it's a little bit of a gloss over to ignore all those terms I agree. The reason that I'm going to do it is because in the small sound speed case, none of those terms are as important. So for uncovering these perturbative conditions of the scaling, I can ignore all of that since it can be empty. So,
But why can't she get rid of those the same way she got rid of the box by terms? And
but again, you can, but there's always a term. Yeah. So that depends what you want to do, right? So what I would say is you write the action so that no higher time derivative. You know, it's just first order in time. All the things you write now, which are first order. And that's an example.
I think if I take the point of view that the redundant operators I can remove by using phrase of motion, seems like I can always trade a Riemann for something involved in the scalar field, because that's the Ribicci
work. There's two ways to do it. This is maybe another discussion.
Yeah.
I use equations of motion to get rid of, or you say that I always want to get rid of double time derivatives, just the first order time derivatives. And that piece, d mu, because it only has powers of first order time derivatives, that's okay. And you can stick at that, and there's no need to use equations of motion to get rid of that
piece. I guess that in Sarah's case, so she's treating these perturbations as more perturbations using Lagrangian. So even if you have double time derivatives here, you really don't care, because you never go to energies when you see the extra power.
But in the spirit, I guess, of like when you say P of X and you're taking seriously,
yes.
The reasonable progress. Yes. So they're the irrelevant properties.
Yeah, I don't think you get any new physics in this context.
Well, it's not exciting
when you're trying to do. You're arguing that you don't have to, but you surely can.
You can, but then you replace it with something else.
But it involves.
But you replace it with the matrix. If you have GMU, okay, you can use the background equation of the motion, but then you replace it with higher order relevant operators in the matrix. Right. Whereas it's easier. Again, it's just a question of what's the best way to write. It's just better to write.
But wouldn't it be, it would fall into the category of the ones you've kept already, wouldn't it? It would be some number of derivatives of scalar fields only. And so shouldn't it be one of the ones she already has?
Well, yeah, it's in the spirit, but you just because you wrote down P5X.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, really, in some ways that was a bad notation, which is like separated off. Yeah. In some ways that doesn't even contain gravitational pieces that would be there at higher order in usual sense, right? So scalar is a bad notation.
So if you're kind of wrong, just to make sure I understand, so what you're saying is that the coefficient that's in front of these higher derivatives will be a function of phi and absorb that, and so it's a function of phi times the state order 6 derivative term. So if you write the Lagrangian as a generic derivative expansion with arbitrary function of phi, that part of that function of phi would be a result of the operator function of phi. So, yeah.
There are already arbitrary functions of phi in front of
the right, so that's what I'm saying. So isn't that equivalent to if I kept that term, and if I get rid of it, it would just add another piece to the arbitrary function, so it's no arbitrary function.
No, but you'll get, I guess I'm saying, so if you have the matter just conventional, and then you make the scalar and gravity part complicated, so you can get rid of it d mu, but in doing so, you would have to redefine the metric, and then you make the matter couple non-minimally to the metric. So it's a question of which you prefer to do. Because it's not that you're plugging in the equation of motion and action, that's how to do that. It's that you're doing the field redefinition. You can get rid of the box phi and so on. But if you pay the price, it's going to pick up another term that does the same thing. That's all. Thanks. Anyway.
Right now, I don't understand.
So yes or no answer question would be, have you got a complete set of operators to the given number of derivatives you have?
So I don't think my set is complete. I think it's complete in the sense that it gives me all of the ones I've written on the screen are all of the ones that are most important for the context that I'm considering.
Uh-huh. Are there other ones?
But there are certainly things I haven't written down, but all of those things either also go away or are less important.
But it's important in the sense that their effect is suppressed by the say
M over M. Exactly. Or slow roll times M over M or something. So, yeah. Okay, so yeah, so with all of those caveats, at 6 derivatives, you can write down 23 terms, and there are 2 actually that after you go through this process you might want to consider. The first one is what you expect x cubed, and the other one is the thing I'm going to call y, which is just some combination of these terms. So this is the major caveat, is that I've suppressed everything that I've not written down everything that has M over M prime or anything else. That's small compared to these. And in, I think in the terminal approach, these were written down as extrinsic curvature terms. And we'll see in the context of the PI exactly why that makes sense. Okay. So why am I actually doing this? Not as an exercise in writing that action so much as with the goal of finding out what the consequences are for the fluctuations. So in that sense, I want to start expanding the action so that I have terms that are of various powers of fluctuations, the background piece, the quadratic term that I use to find the mode equation, the three-point interactions, and so on. And what I'm going to show you, I'm making a lot of simplifications, but you can check that this actually works when you go through and do the calculations. But basically what I'm going to do, first of all, is be a little bit loose about labeling this combination P zeta, because for just this most significant contribution, I can just use this first order gauge transformation to go between the two. And by labeling this P zeta, that keeps in mind that that's the number that we measure, and when you want to plug in the bounds observationally, that's the number to keep in mind. I'm also going to be loose in the sense that I can approximate relationships between, for example, the fact that the energy in fluctuations is less than the energy in the background, or that the loop corrections from the 3-point to the 2-point are small, by, again, approximating and using some tricks to plug in quantities to get terms in the action that are going to need to be the correct bounds. And this is a simple way to do it. You can go through the real calculation and see that you get the same thing. But my notation is going to be a little bit sloppy for that reason, a little bit simplified. So if I do this for the 6 derivative terms, and I put in one more just so you can see what's happening, you can see that if I write down the third order term, the interaction Hamiltonian that contains 3 powers of fluctuation, so this is a 3-point interaction, schematically, so this is not, there are a variety of terms that contribute at this order, but schematically, I have 3 powers of the fluctuation, I have 1 power of this background phi dot, this n to the 4, some powers of h, some powers of cs, and then these are those functions of phi that I might have that should be essentially order 1. This x squared over n to the 4 has come out in this whole process. This is f1. This is coming from y, and you can see that there's this combination here. And then if you keep going to higher order, of course, in terms of things like x cubed, of course, you're just going to recover powers of x over n to the 4. You're also going to recover things at higher order that are combinations of x's and y's, which are going to be combinations of this term and this term. So as long as I take care of this combination of parameters and this one, then I'm okay. So you know, of course, some of what I'm saying here depends on the fact that in order to make a larger effect, I need to evaluate x on some background that gives me a larger effect. So x is really coming from the solution, the equation of motion for phi to get the size. And so this is some combination of epsilon and h as an endpoint.
So are you assuming that x is much smaller than m?
No, I want to look at what if I can push first a moment where x is close to m, so for example, maybe the I limit, and if I'm still okay to ignore the higher derivative terms. In some sense, you would expect that to be true, right? So I'm going to just check.
So these terms are comparable, all of them.
So these terms I would be allowed to keep in that context, right? So if this is order one, of course, I'm keeping all of these. The thing to check is this combination. This combination should be small, right?
Okay.
In order to make this term from a higher derivative term smaller compared to these.
Sorry, in principle, you imagine there's more powers of x over m, and you're just.
Yeah.
You're just studying it at this level to prepare us for what. How you add them all, or?
That's right, but you can see that, at each order, you're going to get particular combinations of things that look like this, things that look like this, and things that are cross derivatives, again, for an entire order. But what I'm saying is, from this structure, you can see that this sort of cross derivative term is going to pick up contributions like this, and all x's, of course, are going to go to 1, and this is what I'm interested in. So I think this is good enough, because I can see this combination, that I can meet.
Are you not claiming that if I went to 18 derivatives, I would only get those two combinations?
No, but I'm just claiming that parametrically, I should be getting weird combinations of this stuff besides this. Right? I should expect that I can control a whole series of derivatives with one particular solution. I mean, up to, issues with term, assuming order one functions.
So is your point that if you take the usual Wilsonian approach, that what you're defining is the cutoff, you're just showing the dynamics of all this stuff and how you cut off it in the
structure? Yeah. Right. So it's sort of the equivalent of sort of some sort of naive dimensional process. Except I'm not actually showing you the loop calculation. Yeah, so what I really want to do, of course, is check this. I don't want to show you that calculation. So instead, what I can do in practice is make some estimate for this ratio, and it turns out to be the same thing. So let me just show you the conditions that I have so far. We wanted this thing to be less than or equal to 1. I still want this to be truly perturbative and not worry about extra degrees of freedom. The slow roll condition initially was just h of red blank less than 1. It's a good condition. It's also sort of a gradient energy condition to make sure my fluctuations are too large. From first derivatives only, so if I had only written that qx and y axis and expanded it, the condition that I get from the 3-point expecting the 2-point is cs to the 4 greater than q zeta. And so also derived in another way by Chong-Gao in their effective filter paper. So they looked at scattering of these fluctuations. In this case, you can get the thing from those terms. So that higher derivative term looked like it was giving me this condition, which looks new. But actually, you can see that combining this condition and this condition, I actually recover that condition. So basically, you just expand this thing like in this combination. So this is another way of writing. It's maybe in some sense a little bit nicer because it involves just sort of fundamental quantities instead of this p zeta. And this is one that's your knowledge. Okay. An interesting side note about this, which was quite at around the same time by the collaboration that included Alberto, is that in this case, if I'm restricting myself to p zeta less than cs to the 4, and cs is a number less than 1, I can't treat the eternally inflating regime where I want the quantum fluctuations to dominate at the same time that I have cs very small. So naturally, in sort of slow roll inflation, you might think that this is your condition for controlling the fluctuations, but it's actually this guy less than 1 over root epsilon. So you have this sort of epsilon room to play where you can treat the eternal inflation regime as still being perturbed. And that's going to be important for the second part of the talk. Okay. So the other thing that we can do is just continue this procedure roughly and ask, what's the entire structure of these correlation functions? Now, the reason that we care about this it has to do with Nagel sanity and testing this observationally. So there's something called the hierarchical structure, which is used a lot by cosmologists because it's what's generated by gravity, naturally, just because of the nonlinear terms of the Keystone action. It's also built into this local ansatz of Nagel sanity. So those, if you assume the local ansatz, your correlation functions obey this type of behavior. It's not necessarily obeyed by other things. Multi-field models, cosmic strings, you know, whatever kind of weird physics you want to throw out there. So in terms of comparing types of statistics to make sure we have, you know, we use all the statistics we have to determine what the physics is, this type of relationship is interesting. It's also, yeah.
So the I guess there's a proportionality factor, which is a power of H.
Yes.
Yeah, so what's the actual statement? In the sense, the proportionality is what? The dependence on omega is proportional. What is proportional to?
So that's right. Essentially, there's a coefficient here
that can be
right, which is some sort of slow roll.
Yes, I guess what I'm saying is that factoring out all the proportionality constants, what is left?
Yes.
Why is this a sensible statement?
So why? So here I'm just looking at if this is related to the 2-point and to what power. So what I ultimately want to know is if sort of there's an order, I can make an expansion in a dimensionless parameter, right, to expand like a probability distribution or something like that. And in this case, so this is the type of structure that arises from gravity. And in that case, you know, this is small. Gravitational couplings are small. And slow roll is small because there's some slow roll parameters. And the question is,
so you're saying, for instance, if zeta squared was like h squared, then zeta in the end was
exactly.
Okay, nice.
So the point is first, is does this mean that it's under control, which is a question about the coefficient? And the second point is just how does it scale to 2-point? So it changes that whole structure. Okay, so again, this is a calculation of the type that Young Peter introduced. And you don't have to do much work here because, again, you can just sort of estimate it. And you can work out by Taylor expanding that initial action of p and x and phi, what the dependence of p zeta is, what the powers of cs are, and it turns out you can approximate the integral really nicely just by using the fact that this is dominated by the time around horizon crossing. So you take the fact that delta t is roughly h, delta x is roughly the whole sound horizon, plug it in, you cancel this L2, you're left with this quantity. And here it should be some order one number again.
So actually, going back to the previous So those coefficients are what's going to be like
Sn
over S2 evaluated at the horizon, or something. That's the S.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but this is for n equal 3 is the consistency relation that holds. So for n equal 3, it's the known consistency relation. This one.
Yeah. Well, it's, I don't know what you mean by consistency.
So the fact that in the local limit, the 3-point function has to be interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's built into this whole. That's the reason that it's there.
But that also holds only in the local limit. Is n equal 3, so it's not general.
So I'm looking. I'm going to look at the scaling in three collateral cases, right? Of course, there's going to be some function, but I'm going to pull out the FNL essentially, so the amplitude of that function, its dependence on the sound speed, on EH, on NME, and check that, right? There's some. Once you do that, you have the amplitude of that, and of course, there's some shape in there, but that shape is still multiplied by something that's this guy's parameter.
Yeah, the estimate works just as well. You just calculate the ratio of a cubic part in the action of what I think has for
I mean, yeah, for this one, you just get 1 over CS squared. But the thing is, you can do that to all orders in C. Okay, so essentially, if I evaluate that integral for some nth power, I get a term that looks like this. And you can see that it is hierarchical. That's some factors of the sound speed. The only reason we worry about that is that the sound speed is small. It's a small parameter. It's apparently increasing power in the denominator. That's essentially the reason for that, for Schrodinger condition. And the thing that you're interested in is the dimensionless combination. So here I've just taken this endpoint function and made the dimensionless combination. This is the thing that appears when you start expanding probability distributions or something like that. So this is something you want to be sensible. And you just get that coefficient, this quantity to the n minus 2. So you can see that this perturbative condition guarantees essentially that I'm allowed to, it's the same thing coming back. It's just another way of writing the same expression. That even for the case where the sound speed is small and you have these increasing powers in the denominator, that same perturbative condition guarantees that you're allowed to expand the probability around the Gaussian and things like that. So the summary then is, as long as this is less than or equal to 1, you're allowed to just take the p of x and y action up to, if you want to know if sum speed equal 1, you have to worry about these computational terms. Furthermore, the correlation functions have this hierarchical expression, and you can rewrite that perturbative condition in terms of the more fundamental parameters like this. And then, because those conditions are related, as soon as you hit this limit, the higher derivative term becomes important at the same time as that whole series of first derivative terms. So that's interesting for the brain inflation things. Oops, I need that. So the reason that's interesting is that the initial formulation of this brain inflation case, which Leanne introduced this morning, looks like it has a sound speed that can get arbitrarily large. That doesn't make sense, of course. So arbitrarily small, so now you have to get arbitrarily large. So that shouldn't make sense, and the reason that was happening is it looked like the thing that was setting your warp string scale was different from the thing that was generating H. So you had different parameters to play with there. There was no reason to cut it off. And that's a little bit funny if you want to start comparing with observation, whatever. So what happens? The original brain action, you don't have to worry about the details that I showed you, was this square root part, some potential, which I wasn't concerned with. The reason that this funny function of the warp string scale was appearing was because of the warp factor in the background space. But you can sort of guess what happens. So first, let me just say that the terms that appear are the extrinsic curvature terms of the brain, just like the Fermilli picture. And those are less than the warp string scale. So in some sense, they're under control from the string theory point of view. And there's some evidence that the terms that correct this action look like this. And in fact, they have the structure that you expect. And when you hit the point where this thing, essentially, where your sound speed is so small, that you hit that perturbative limit, it's OK. You thought DBI was a sensible theory. It's still a sensible theory because, in fact, those corrections are there. So you can't just, you don't have a sensible theory that removes the issue off to sound speed equals 0. OK. And the summary of all that implication for observation is first the question of how non-Gaussian can you be. So So we know that in slow roll, with FNL, really small, like 0.04. Observationally, at CME scales, we can get something like the order of 100. The theoretical bound is 10 to 9 caps. So you can see the two things are the statement that we usually say, fluctuations are very Gaussian, is the difference between this number and this number. We have a long way to go observationally before we get the slow roll limit, so that's why there's a lot of discovery space in there. And because we actually can compute things to a much higher level, and this is only measured at CME scales, we could expect there to be some sort of physics that gives us interesting, even higher level than this, at smaller scales, but we don't expect anything bigger than this. So that's what this one that I focus. Yeah, that's fine.
Sorry, you mean as long as FNL is less than that, it's perturbative?
Yeah, so since we start out doing the calculation at CME scales that way, usually we don't assume that that calculation changes when we feed that into observation. So of course, if you know better, you can do better. But if you're starting with that assumption, then you shouldn't believe that FNL runs to above 10 or 9, and you're consistent.
If it does, then that means your theory works. Your calculation is not.
It's not consistent, so you should go back and check. Which is good, right? Because you don't want to create thousands of primordial black holes at small scales or something from this model. So.
Well, if it's the wrong time, it doesn't.
Right, exactly. The second reason this matters, then, like I said, is just for correlation. The two types of statistics you can use would be, you know, really calculations of correlation functions, like measuring the bispectrum in the CME, or some elements of galaxies, or anything else, essentially. Anything else might be topological features of the CME, or counting the number of clusters, where what you're doing is looking at the area under this curve. And usually the translation between comparing the constraints from these statistics and these statistics depends on being able to do something like write this hierarchical set of correlation functions. That's usually what people do, because that's what it looks sort of natural. So if you have some multi-field model or cosmic string model where for some reason you don't have a 3-point, but you have a 4-point, something like that, you're going to be confused if you use the wrong way of translating between these two. So, okay. So now let me put those constraints in a different context. And this part is really coming from discussions with Sash Sarangi and Andrew and Mark here. And so it's just a different way to see those constraints and to see what happened to those sound speed constraints that we came out with. But I'm not sure, I don't know to what extent these guys agree with me. So what I'm going to show you is I take responsibility for errors, but it's from discussions with them. So why do we even care about this? I think the first point is that what we've done so far, especially with this constraint, is we've calculated things in our local patch, which we observe. That's fine. That's great. But there are some questions that we'd be interested in a more global picture for, particularly for how we might explore the landscape, whether eternal inflation happens, things like that. We might hear, maybe for Martin tomorrow or Friday, a little bit about a possibility of using Fokker-Planck to understand sort of certain types of loop calculations. And the point is just, again, to understand the relationship between the fact that when you add interactions, you get non-Gaussianity, and you also get the forest deviations from exactness error. And it'd be nice if this tool of the Fokker-Planck could actually remain once you go to adding these derivative corrections. Okay. So let me show you the form that you've probably seen before. So F here is the probability distribution for the input term as a function of phi. So usually you imagine a distribution of Hubble-sized regions, for example, and how those evolve with time. You have two terms, usually. You have a term that looks like just a diffusion equation, and a term that looks like a drift. So it depends on the slope of the potential. So if this isn't here, you just have a random walk, essentially. If this is here, you have a random walk down the slope. And this is actually a statement of probability conservation. So if you're not doing inflation, you might derive this thing from some sort of master equation where you look at the probability to jump away from a point and to a point per unit time. So this W is going to be a transition probability per unit time from position phi to position phi prime. And the result is just integrating over all the possible other positions you could be besides one. So often what people do is that you assume that probability distribution is sharply peaked. So when I'm on my inflationary potential, the odds are that I jump to some position relatively close, order h, back to where I was before. So you can tailor expand in that difference in position. And if you do that, up to quadratic order, you're right back at the Fokker-Planck equation, where these things are actually defined in terms of these jump moments. So you take the probability per unit time to jump some distance here, call that mu1. And that's essentially, since it's per unit time, there's a delta t here. And so this is essentially given by the classical rolling of the field. This one, in the limit where you can ignore the classical part, is just given by this quantum part. So I put the little q here for quantum. Okay? And usually what we do is calculate this quantum mechanically. This is the classical part, we put it back in, and we get the Fokker Planck. So how does that calculation go? Well, usually you write down the solution for the mode equation, and you ask, what's the effect on the background of modes that came outside the horizon that contributed their kick to the background during a time delta t? So you integrate out those modes from h to h, e to h delta t. There's a 1 over delta t from the fact that more of the probability per unit time. And everything I'm going to say for the next few slides was nicely repeated by Linde in this paper. And what do you get? So you can take a few examples. So for a massless field, that was the case where specifically the solution is this Hankel function with the power that we had. And that case is extremely simple. If it's exactly massless in a fixed to center background, that's the case where you get the exact diffusion equation. And it's really nice because you get exactly what you expect, but the turnaround current just depends on h. So you get a Gaussian distribution whose variance grows in time. And of course, if you look at times of order h inverse, then you just get the same square root. The next step of complexity you can do is to claim that you have a massive field that's still in a fixed to center background. So in other words, you force the mass to be much, much less than h, which effectively for the potential means you add some positive piece that dominates. So we want to allow a slope in the potential, but we want to have h fixed in comparison. That shifts this power of the order of the Hankel function from 3/2 to something slightly different. It depends on the ratio of the mass of the field to h. And if you perform that same integration of modes exiting the horizon, you get a surprise because you get a term that actually, in the small time limit, it grows with t. But at length times, this part drops out and you just write at a constant, which is surprisingly large because it's h over m and not just h. Okay. But what do you do to plug that in the Fokker-Planck equation? Your jump moment for delta phi looks exactly the same. Okay, so in the small time limit, you recover that massless case. So you plug this guy in. And the only difference here is that you have a drift term, right? So the equation looks like this. So you can see, in effect, what you're doing is that the effect was so small here of adding that mass term that it drops out in the small time limit. But this equation, because you add the drift, essentially sums all of those back up, and we're going to get that same solution again that has that stationary state. And you can check that you're perfectly fine to ignore a whole bunch of other terms that you might wonder why they're not there. So of course you can ignore the classical variation of the field in a time delta t, because assuming that phi zero dot is essentially fixed, that guy vanishes on small times. You can ignore all the higher point functions also, because those also vanish with higher powers of delta t. And the plentiful effects, because this is Gaussian, they're just powers of the 2-point, and those also vanish with delta t. So it's completely reasonable to make that transformation to the Gaussian. And you can also check the behavior of the various moments. So for example, you can check that the behavior of the expectation value of phi follows the classical equation of motion. If we plug that in, we should get it back. You can also check what happens to the variance. So remember, doing that whole integral, we found that there was not only that small time limit, but that interesting late time limit. And you can check that this equation from the Fokker-Planck does in fact reproduce that interesting limit. You can also check that if you look at higher order terms in that same stationary late time limit, there's no 3-point, and the 4-point is exactly the 2-point squared. Yeah, the solution to this guy is the 2-point function squared, essentially. So you cover exactly everything you expect. It's very simple. That's the standard case. Okay. So far we've allowed delta t to go to zero. So when we start adding interactions and a slope to the potential, so I'm going to allow the potential to vary, we have to worry a little bit about time scales. So for example, the integration that I did on the previous slide assumed that h was constant. And h is only constant on a time scale that's of order epsilon times h inverse. which you can write for the small nest case like this. And that's perfectly fine because in fact you reach the stationary solution on a time scale that's less than this, so it's a consistent calculation. So if H is not constant, so now we want to add the fact that not only do we have a massive field, but we're going to allow the mass of that field to actually contribute to the background. So H is not constant, then we have to worry that we're using the right stochastic variable for the right time scale. So for example, you might worry that you should be using the velocity as the stochastic variable for the acceleration, and that depends on how fine of resolution you look. So we want to use the stick with the position, so we want to check that the quantum corrections to the velocity and acceleration are small for the time scales we're interested in, and that gives us some conditions on what that time scale should be that are essentially related to the small parameter eta and the amplitude of fluctuations. So there's a nice range. Turns out that these constraints are reciprocals of each other. So for H, delta T of order H inverse, usually you're fine to sit in between these bounds, since this is less than 1, this is less than 1. Okay, so that's what I said. This time interval is usually fine. That's what we're interested in, typically anyway, because we want the time, we want the kickstroke region to give it time to sort of reproduce itself in the eternally inflating machine. So we want the quantum perturbations to dominate, and that's exactly the eternal inflation condition. Okay, so why am I telling you all this? I'm going to get to the sound speed case. But first, let's just check that this made sense again in the case where H is now varying and what happens. So if we're going to allow H to vary, now in addition to having a V prime term, we're going to have an H prime term. So in other words, the mass term is going to dominate over the constant. I still want the constant because I don't want to take the fixedness of it. So now we can't assume anything particular about that wait time solution. Essentially, you can go back and check that H is not constant now over the enough time to take that solution. This condition means that you can't take that integral long enough to recover that fixed solution. Here's epsilon. But that's okay. You still get the same short time solution for this term. And now all you need to do is plug in the fact that H can vary with time as well. So that's inside this, inside the derivatives here. And you can solve that, and that's done a long time ago. And again, you can check things like you recover the classical equation of motion. But if you look at the evolution of the two-point and the higher order functions, they don't go to a stationary solution. So this was evolved numerically by these guys long ago. And you can see that it develops something into something that's going downstream. So these are two different time steps, essentially, of letting that distribution evolve. And phi is moving toward the origin, so it's rolling down the hill, and the distribution generates this little tail up here. Okay, so that problem that was done long ago was the first step of adding interactions to this thing. There are two other ways that we can consider that we might need to add interactions. The first would be higher order terms in that expansion of the master equation, which would look like higher order correlation functions. And the final one would be checking that we actually did the right quantum calculation of the correlation functions that we plugged into the master equation. So I want to show how both of those things are kind of interesting in the small sound speed case. So first, the slow roll case is pretty easy. You can take a typical term in the slow roll action. This is a typical term in terms of its scaling. And it's, they get a three-point function. You can check that what it gives for the three-point function space divided by a vector delta t, where delta t is of order h, is just epsilon h to the fifth over n prime. You can check that adding that term to the Fokker-Planck equation and checking that contribution is small compared to these two gives you exactly the value you would expect, h over n prime less than 1. Nothing particularly interesting going on there. And that's also what you got from just verifying that the energy of fluctuations was small, so it makes sense. The small sound speed case is more interesting. So what I mean here by small sound speed is whenever 1 minus cs squared is bigger than epsilon. So it doesn't have to be particularly small. But this is just the condition that in the three-point function, these type of terms dominate. So we're going to be able to simplify because we can ignore a lot of factors of small. In that case, the dominant terms are modified by powers of the sound speed. So now a typical term looks like this, where cs appears in the power spectrum and it also appears with extra powers in the denominator here, and that gives a correction to the three-point that looks like this. So if you plug that into the Fokker-Planck equation and demand that those corrections are small compared to the quadratic one, you get back the gradient energy bound that we had before. So that makes sense, right? The Fokker-Planck equation, once you plug everything in, is sort of this possible evolution of the background. So what it should be sensitive to is how those gradients and fluctuations affect the, if those are marked or not.
Did you mean to say it's cube squared there?
No, cube. That was the gradient bound from before. So CS squared was the bound from the loop corrections. They're different. And this one is less restrictive, which is why it's interesting. Okay, and you can check that the fourth order gives the same condition, so there's nothing there. Okay, so far with that condition, that h of red plane is less than CS cubed, it looks like there's no problem with eternal inflations. The problem is that when we calculated this quantity to plug into the Fokker Planck equation, which is expectation times, we did this integral here, and we integrated over, essentially we did a quantum calculation, integrating over the modes leaving the horizon. So that's the point where we should go back and also do a loop calculation again. So essentially, it's a mimic of the case that you do to check that the three-point fluctuations to the two-point in k-space are large. It's just an analog of that correction. And you get exactly the same thing. For a typical term, you get some sort of log correction with some prefactor. And it's the prefactor that gives you the same condition that we had before. When you do that integral, which is this one in here, which is that t zeta over cs to the fourth. So the Fokker-Planck equation is sensitive to both of those bounds, the gradient energy bound in adding sort of those in the classical evolution of once you've already calculated the moments and stuck them in, you recover the gradient energy bounds. And by the fact that you really had to do a quantum calculation, use that equation in the first place, it's also sensitive to these kind of recuperative bounds. So unfortunately, that means that it seems like you can't use this to do eternal inflation in a small sound speed case, as far as I can see, which would be great if it was still useful somehow. It might still be useful in other contexts, even in the small sound speed case, because certainly you don't have to work in that eternal inflation limit. But I wonder what the implications of that are then for studying tunneling or landscape with small sound speed.
So I think I made some connection there.
Sure. I'm sorry.
Did you somewhere show that any eternal regime is biased to that?
Yeah, that was a long time ago, but basically that was, sorry, we went fast, probably, but that was basically just p zeta order 1, z eternal inflating regime.
So z eta order 1.
Yeah, so as soon as CS is significantly less than 1, so that these dominate.
I see. So since p zeta must be less than minus CS to the 4th, we can never have.
Yeah. So it's a little bit disappointing because you'd like to think there's a global picture that's still valid when you have those derivative interactions. And you can see that initially I might have thought, well, it's the fact that, you know, the smaller sound horizons, you actually are generating larger gradients. But that appears in a different context, and that constraint is less constraining. So it's really this one that comes back to get you, it seems to me. Okay, so let me try to summarize what I said. The first part was just, we're interested in examining these actions because we want to determine differences between fundamental and inflationary physics. And to do that, we really need to take every model that we can conceivably write down and look at the properties that differentiate it from other models and the qualitative features that people can go look for observationally. And two particular things that you might do for single field models is make sure that any model that you have with the right sound speed or whatever is consistent in the sense that sound speed is bounded, so the right sound amplitude is bounded. And then it also has a particular form of correlation quotients, which is very natural. But if you want to take some other model, some multi-field model, you can contrast that with a single field case by looking at the structure of the correlation. I'd be interested to see what happens to my bound of p zeta compared to cs to the 4 when you add these conditions from the initial state. Maybe specifically because of the DBI case, actually. So some factors of beta that appear there. And in the second part, the question was, we have this sort of nice alternative way of looking at inflation and stochastic inflation. It's interesting that you can recover those same kinds of gradient bounds and perturbative bounds in different contexts. It seems too bad that seems to limit you to not looking at the eternal inflation regime. But maybe there's some way around that you can still use this to look at the global inflation. Okay, awesome.
One thing I didn't quite catch when you were talking about, you had some expression with a curly F tensor with four indices as a correction to DBI. What was the statement?
So the statement was that curly F was just a function, essentially, that I think you can determine in some particular cases. But the statement was that there's some function, which is essentially a function of phi, times exactly that type of operator that I had, that Y operator. And there's some, you know, X's times Y. So that function was a sum of 1 plus powers of X's times that Y thing. And this the statement is that that's sort of a known correction in some very particular supersymmetric context to the EDI action. So
is the claim that that's the leading one, or
yeah, I mean that's the claim in some context. Now, of course, in the particular case of brain inflation, it's more complicated, and I would imagine that that's not the full answer. But it makes me a little bit happy to see that even though I think EDI is some complete model, of course it can, it knows when that perturbative bound is violated, and those other terms actually exactly where you can get it. That was all.
Any other questions?
So, I have a question about your second point here. You're saying corrections cannot be calculated in current geology. What do you mean exactly by corrections?
Oh, sorry. So, if I was using, sorry, I think this was a sentence that I should have changed given that I skipped a couple things, but if I was using Fokker plane to calculate tunneling rates or something like that, some sort of Hopkin laws, I think that you have a lot of trouble if you want to see how that expression changes with small sound speed by using something like Fokker plane, because actually it's not valid in the regime. So what I should have said here is that just the internally inflated regime cannot be easily calculated using Fokker plane with small sound speed, as far as I can see.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the fact that, in a sense, your perturbation theory breaks down for small sound speed when you enter the beneficial regime is that you probably that cannot consistently claim that in such models there is a thermal inflation.
That's right, and that's the interesting point, I think, is what you would like to claim is that there's not. And since these terms sort of arise naturally, if you could get rid of a whole bunch of stochastic internal inflation models by claiming that, that would be great. Unfortunately, I'm not, although I would like to claim that, and this is more evidence in my direction, maybe it's not really, because the tool actually just depends on the same thing.
I would say then you're even worse, because even if you don't go into the general information you want to calculate, then you can't trust that, because that's also a sort of where I come.
Yes, so it's always been, I guess, sort of interesting that the stationary solution agrees with this, or can I do calculation, or any kind of this case, that it means that.
I can't understand what you mean by tunneling. I thought you were talking about internal inflation, the random walk type.
That's right. So sorry, yes. So I'm really talking about Hopkin laws. So sometimes,
Something I'm confused. Like, I remember there used to be this other parameter that in EDI would go to zero, that lambda that were related to third derivative of P with respect to X and or higher derivative.
Lambda, yeah.
So then, shouldn't they, when you calculate this bonds?
Yeah, that's right. So of course, at each order, there is a function of phi, which is this lambda, whatever. So I'm assuming that those functions are normal order one. There's nothing weird, no special cancellations in those functions. But really, yeah, just like you have a solar hierarchy of parameters that depend on those coefficients in principle, there would be a hierarchy that depends specifically on those functions.
Yeah. No other questions. Let's thank Sarah again and all the speakers.